Now, at the beginning of the 21st century, religions are dying out. This isn't a distant problem. It's happening right here, right now. Here, outside our local Catholic church, the day-to-day crowds bustle past, but few people these days pass through the doors of this magnificent old building. It's a forlorn place, a shadow of its former self, the smell of incense fading, the threat of hellfire pale. But you can help. Just £30 will pay for enough incense for a week's worth of services, or enough windoline for a month. £300 will pay for the re-gilding of a pulpit from which to preach the sanctity of poverty. And £3,000 will pay for the discreet relocation of a priest who, despite no hint of wrongdoing whatsoever, might suddenly find his services required elsewhere. So think. Just a small donation will help secure the future for a Catholic church in your area, and ensure that the holy pall of guilt can be enjoyed by our children and grandchildren. Thank you.
It's the 25th of March, 2011, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. Is it possible to introduce a story about Catholic Church child abuse in a light-hearted way? With so many ways to spell Gaddafi, how do we know we're bombing the right one? Is Tyler Cohen complaining about running out of low-hanging fruit because he's been the victim of apple scrumping? Are computers going to stop getting better, and is this bad news for Windows Vista users? Did life on Earth originate from outer space, and does this explain Lembitopic? And do we really have a punk cover of a Christmas song with adapted lyrics to be about the budget at the end of the show? But first, who won Secularist of the Year, and did they insist that despite winning that they should receive no special privileges or prizes, and that all nominees should be treated equally? In a week where a report suggested that religion may become extinct in 9 countries, we can't help but feel a little bit responsible. So in a bid to cover our tracks, we're going to try and hasten the process by telling you a bit about what happened at last weekend's Secularist of the Year Awards, which is hosted by the National Secular Society. This year, the Secularist of the Year Award, also known as the Irwin Prize, went to Dutch MEP Sophie Intveld, who has been tirelessly campaigning for secular values in the European Parliament. Incidentally, the Pod Delusion was also up for this award, and obviously we didn't win. I'm not bitter or anything. I just reckon I could have given an equally inspiring and enchanting and fascinating and clever and interesting speech, totally off the cuff, to the large assembled audience. And after all, she only won because of her tireless campaigning for the rights of women and gay people on the European stage and standing up to the Pope and doing all of that really important stuff. Not that I'm bitter or anything. I guess she did sort of deserve to win. So after the awards, I sat down with her and I spoke to her about her work in the Parliament. So we're here with the winner of this year's Secularist of the Year Prize, Sophie Intveld, the Dutch MEP. Sophie, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
So what are the major challenges that you faced in the European Parliament?
Well, we see that there's an increasing presence and influence of religious groupings, churches, the Vatican in particular, on European politics. Mm. On the one hand, because they're getting more involved, they're better organized. On the other hand, also because Europe is moving into areas where questions like, for example, family law, freedom of speech, sexual and reproductive health rights, they play a major role. So those are the topics that are of interest to churches. And I think that the secularist voice needs to be much better heard. It needs to be better organized because, you know, secularists tend to be not organized because let's say that you're a non-football fan, that's hardly a reason to create an association or to get organized. Or if you're there's so many things that you are not, and yet you don't get organized. But that puts us at a disadvantage. It makes that conservative religious voices are disproportionately represented. Mm. They have a very firm grip on politics. And the Vatican in particular, in addition to being a regular religious lobby, also has official diplomatic ties with the European Union institutions because it kind of abuses of its position as a state. So,
I believe the Pope's been invited to speak at the European Parliament, and you were involved in arguing against that.
Yes, well, he's at periodic intervals he's been invited. I think the previous Pope or a previous Pope once visited the Parliament in the 80s, which I wasn't there yet, but apparently there was a scene because Reverend Paisley, who was at the time also a member of the European Parliament, called him the Antichrist and was then removed by security guys. So I think ever since, popes have been somewhat reluctant to come to the European Parliament. I read once that somebody in his circles had said that he doesn't want to come to Parliament because it's full of militant secularists. So yes, but I think he can visit the Parliament and they can hold a conference. We can have a debate. I have no problem with that. This is a democracy. Everybody can make their voice heard. What I do have a problem with is a monologue from a religious leader in front of the Parliament. We are the elected representatives of all European citizens, and religious leaders have no place in our parliamentary assembly. In the building they can have a meeting, but not in the chamber.
So I guess the next question would be, is the European Parliament full of militant secularists? Because sort of like countries like Poland, for instance, are incredibly religious. Is there much religious influence? I mean, you recently wrote about...
Countries aren't religious. People are. And things also evolve. The debate in Poland is incredibly lively. Mm. And I think there, so far, let's say... On most issues, most votes, we still have the majority, but not always. And you have to make people very aware. You also see, for example, countries like Spain, that used to be the stronghold of the Catholic Church. This is an Opus Dei country. They were the Poland of Europe before Poland came in. And what happens now is that under the Zapatero government, they're moving away rapidly from... let's say, severing the ties, the official ties with the church. They're kicking the church out of the education system. They're cutting their funding. They're passing laws against the will of the Catholic Church. So there's a real battle. Mm. And I noticed that my Spanish colleagues from the Socialist Party mainly are extremely... they're very committed to this. For them, it's really a big issue. So you cannot say one country or another. We see in many countries. My own, the Netherlands, used to be a very progressive, liberal, open and tolerant country. Well, no longer. In the previous government, there was a fairly conservative Christian party, so not the regular middle-of-the-road Christian Democrats, but really a party that doesn't believe in the separation of church and state. Now, we have a minority government that depends on the support of the fundamentalist Christians in parliament. We have fundamentalist Christians. Mm. That is allowed in my country. They're in parliament. They don't believe that women should have a right to vote. They don't believe in the separation of church and state. And this, the government of my country depends on their support. So you cannot say, it's those Eastern European conservative countries. It doesn't work that way. It's much more complicated than that.
Do you think it is possible to achieve, the things that we want, secularism, nice attitudes towards gay rights and things, from the European Parliament? Or do you think the national parliaments still hold a lot of sway? Because, for instance, Hungary have recently got in... I can't remember the name, so I'm going to call them crackpots, who are forcing... Is it a law about... Which family values?
They're writing it into the constitution now, family values. But no, the events in Hungary are definitely extremely worrying, extremely worrying. But let's say so far, the European Parliament has always been the champion of fundamental rights. And very often, let's say, very conservative religious views and fundamental rights don't sit together very well. So, automatically, if we defend and promote fundamental rights in the European Parliament, there will be some frictions with the church. Though I have to say, it's not strictly you cannot say it's, let's say, atheist versus religious people, because in our platform for secularism we work together with Protestants, with Catholics, with Jews. Unfortunately, Muslims are not well represented. But we, you know, there are also religious people who are very progressive and liberal, and they are staunch defenders of the separation of church and state. Or even the French, for example, who really climbed the barricades to defend their model of what they call laïcité, separation of church and state, which is very strict. So you cannot say it's a strict division between religious people and non-religious people. It's a bit more subtle than that.
I think on that nice uniting note, I think we'll leave it there. Sophie Entwistle, Secularist of the Year, congratulations and thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can hear a podcast of the full ceremony, including a speech by A.C. Grayling and a couple of other awards, on the Pod Delusion Extra feed. You can find that on iTunes and on our website at poddelusion.co.uk. We also have an interview with Professor Grayling in the next few weeks, but we can't run it just yet because he has a contract granting someone else exclusivity with him. Presumably he's appearing on the new L'Oreal advert with his amazing hair, because he's worth it. Now, in a slightly awkward tone shift, also at the Secularist of the Year Awards was Sue Cox, who's founded the new organisation for victims of Catholic Church child abuse. Liz Luckendorf spoke to her and asked questions in a much more sincere voice than I could ever hope to muster.
At the Irwin Prize last Saturday, I had a chance to sit down for a few minutes with Sue Cox, one of the organisers of Survivor's Voice Europe. She was one of the individuals who spoke out at the protest the Pope in September last year as a victim of clerical abuse. Though there are no doubt many positive aspects of the protest, one in particular was the creation of Survivor's Voice Europe, an organisation dedicated to building public awareness of abuse of children by institutions, and also, quote, require the Vatican to accept responsibility for the actions of its paedophile priests, make amends to the survivors of clerical sexual abuse, adopt a zero-tolerance policy concerning sexual abuse by its priests, and create secular extensive outreach and support system for past and future survivors of clergy sexual abuse. No easy task. Sue talked to me about the forthcoming event in London on Saturday the 26th, but also their wider activities this year. So I'm here with Sue Cox from Survivor's Voice, and we're at the NSS Irwin Prize. What did you think of the winner?
I thought she was fabulous. I thought she was brilliant. Isn't she excellent? She's amazing. I mean, a worthy, worthy winner.
As I understand it, you have an event this weekend in conjunction with Survivor's Voice. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, it's the launch of Survivor's Voice Europe. These are all survivors of Catholic clergy abuse that come from all over the world. So America, Holland, Rome, England, USA, Germany. We've got people coming from all over the world. We joined together last year after the protest of the Pope March, which I was part of, and then I was asked to go to Rome and met these international survivors as well. So this is an international movement. So the launch of Survivors Voice Europe is next Saturday, the 26th of March at 1:30 at Conway Hall, and it's free. So lots of people are there, and it should be a really interesting presentation. Hope people can come.
So you mentioned protest the Pope, and how, as an event, it kind of, I think, took everyone within
absolutely
London and the secular
absolutely
community by storm.
Yeah.
So what did that mean for your organisation?
There was just me actually, because I just I was asked to do the opening speech, which I did, shaking in my shoes when I saw how many people were there, and it really stemmed from that. So actually, the protest, the Pope March, set off this international movement, because I would not have been contacted by the Americans, I would not have gone to Rome, I wouldn't have been shocked with what I saw. Not only did I meet lots of survivors, but among them, there were 60 deaf and speech impaired people from Verona, all of whom had been systematically abused by priests in their childhood, in their institution, when they hadn't got a voice. One man was abused by 16 priests. And if you can imagine an elderly gentleman signing what had happened to him as a little boy without a voice. It's impossible to turn your back on that. So, you know, it's serendipity. I came out, as it were, about my abuse. I was asked to make the speech. From that, I got a bit of bravery about me. I was contacted by the Americans. So, in effect, the protest of the Pope March started all of that off. So that's what it meant to us, really.
So you have the event this Saturday, and what else are you planning this year? What else do
well,
you have in
mind? We've got several things. We're meeting in Washington in June. We have a meeting in Italy, in Verona, in May. We're going back to Rome in October, right back into the Vatican's backyard. We've got a psychological research being done this year, where we are, in conjunction with a couple of clinical psychologists, we're looking at the long-term psychological damage from childhood abuse. We're looking at the neuroscience of it, because brain damage occurs. Doesn't matter whether it's bombs or bastards, it's still the same.
That's a fantastic
post-trauma
slogan.
Post-trauma. So we're going to be researching that. We are translating a lot of the books that are coming out of Italy. One of the people that will be at the thing on Saturday is Dr. Tommaso Dallora, who was a child victim, but it was also commandeered into Opus Dei and has been instrumental in writing a very damning book about the wider abuses of Opus Dei, and he's coming to present on Saturday as well. So we're going to be hopefully translating a lot of these really, really amazing books that are coming out. We've got a group of young musicians that are making a record, a Survivor's Voice record, so we're hoping that that will come out. And we're going to be, at some point, we're going to be doing some international seminars about the brain damage occurred to child sexual abuse, apart from lending our voice to all the other secular activities that go on, and hopefully we've got a petition out to the United Nations. A child abuse expert lawyer will be coming on Saturday. He has... He's been involved with Keith and various people to try and lobby and really sort of do a pincer movement on the United Nations and various... So we're quite militant and quite active, really.
That's great to hear.
In only the way that passionate people can be, really. You've got to...
Well, maybe next year we'll see you here as a nominee as well.
Oh, no, I don't deserve that. But certainly I shall be here, because I wouldn't be anywhere else. It's been lovely.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure. It's nice to meet you as well.
Though some of you may be helping to protest the cuts this weekend, if there are those of you who want to do something that involves more sitting down and fomenting righteous anger, you can head to Conway Hall on Saturday for Survivor's Voice Europe. You can follow links on the Pod Delusion website for more information on this event and that of Survivor's Voice. This has been Liz Luxendorf for the Pod Delusion.
There's been a lot of talk in the press about whether or not the bombing of Libya, what we're doing there, is within international law. But what's also important, and perhaps overlooked, is whether it falls within our own rules for starting wars. Does it abide by the British Defence Doctrine? Adam Jacobs investigates. Colonel Gaddafi's location is currently unknown, and nor have I heard anything about the location of his son, Saif Gaddafi. I wonder if he's in his safe room.
British armed forces have once again been called upon to exercise that most onerous of all responsibilities, namely the use of deadly force in the pursuit of government policy. This is generally known as war. Now, we Pod Delusion folk tend to be rather geeky and academic, and we like to think about the theories behind things, so I thought it would be interesting to look at the current conflict in Libya from a theoretical perspective. And since my own military career was extremely brief and totally lacking in any kind of glory, the theory of war was as far as I ever got anyway, so the theoretical aspects are all I'm really qualified to talk about. The theory of war is not new, and probably as old as war itself. One particularly influential military theorist was Karl von Clausewitz, whose famous book On War was published in 1832. Of course, the technical nature of warfare has changed greatly since then, but much of his writing is still surprisingly relevant to the present day. His theories have been refined over the years by more modern military theorists, drawing on experience of more recent conflicts, but they're still very much recognisable in the principles of war used by the British military today. These principles are described in a document called British Defence Doctrine. It's not classified or anything, so if you're interested, you can download it from the MOD website. It's very easy to find if you just type British Defence Doctrine into Google. Every conflict is different, of course, and the principles of war are not intended to be a detailed instruction manual on how to fight. Rather, they're intended to be a set of broadly applicable principles that military commanders should keep in mind, but not follow slavishly. There are 10 principles of war, and I'm going to look at how the conflict in Libya measures up against them. I'll take them in reverse order, although the order doesn't actually matter anyway for the most part. I'll let you know when it does. Principle number 10 is sustainability. This is mainly about having enough personnel and kit in the right place to do the job, what military folk call logistics. It seems that everything's going well on this front. This is mainly a problem if you're trying to maintain supply lines in a hostile environment. Here we have friendly NATO air bases in southern Italy that we're using, and there's no reason to think that we should have any sustainability problems. So a good score on that one. Principle 9 is cooperation. Cooperation can be between different armed forces within a country or between countries. Again, we seem to be doing well. We've had coordinated attacks from Royal Navy submarines and RAF jets, and of course many of our NATO allies are joining in, as well as some non-NATO countries, and they all appear to be working well together. So a big tick for cooperation. Principle 8 is flexibility. One important feature of military planning is that wars tend to be unpredictable, and plans need to be flexible so that they can adapt to changing circumstances. It's a bit early to know how flexible our plans are, as we're still in the early phases of the operation. However, one encouraging sign is that one RAF bombing raid earlier this week was aborted when civilians were spotted in the target area. Principle 7 is economy of effort. This is about not using more resources than necessary to achieve the desired effect. Perhaps we didn't have a great start here, as flying sorties with aircraft based in Norfolk wasn't the most economical way of attacking Libya. But on the whole, we're not doing too badly, with a relatively small number of well-targeted strikes against key elements of Gaddafi's military. That's a lot more economical than sending in ground troops. Principle 6 is concentration of force. This is about making sure that you're using overwhelming force at critical points of battle. We've done pretty well there. I doubt that there's much that Gaddafi's forces could do to defend any military installation facing concerted attack by the sophisticated weaponry of either our RAF planes or the Tomahawk land attack missiles launched from our submarines. Principle 5 is surprise. Well, this was always going to be a bit challenging when it took several weeks to get a UN resolution. But although Gaddafi's forces probably knew they were going to be attacked, it would have been difficult for them to know precisely where and when. Using a submarine to launch Tomahawk missiles was a smart move here. The location of our submarines is highly classified, and although Gaddafi's forces may well have guessed we had a submarine deployed nearby, it's highly unlikely they could have known where and when it would attack. So we at least had some element of surprise, even though we didn't score as highly on this principle as some of the others. Principle 4 is security. This is making sure that your own operations aren't compromised by enemy action. Since our own operations are acting from a distance and from secure military bases, there's not much that Gaddafi's forces can do about them, so they're really pretty secure. So another big tick for security. Principle 3 is offensive action. This is about taking the fight to the enemy and making sure the action is on your own terms, not waiting for the enemy to act and then simply reacting. Again, the operation scores highly here. We've picked some targets and we've gone and bombed the crap out of them. Top marks on this one. Principle 2 is maintenance of morale. This is all about keeping a healthy fighting spirit among the troops. It's hard for those of us not involved in the operations to know what morale is like, but my guess is it would be quite high. Armed forces train extensively for moments such as this, and the ability to put their training into action in what no doubt seems to many to be a just cause is probably a great morale boost. I think we can probably give this one a tick too. Now, remember I said earlier that the order mostly doesn't matter, but I'd let you know when it does? Well, this is the bit where the order matters. We're now coming on to principle number 1, and it's number 1 for a reason, as it's the most important. The order of the others doesn't really matter. All 9 are considered to be of roughly equal importance. But principle number 1 is more important than all of them. So, principle number 1, the most important principle, is selection and maintenance of the aim. This is about having a single, unambiguous aim. All operations should be directed towards achieving that aim, often known in military parlance as the end state. Now, we did pretty well on the 9 subordinate principles, but on this one most important principle, it all seems to go a bit pear-shaped. What exactly is the desired end state? The immediate aim is to stop Gaddafi's forces being able to attack the rebels with their overwhelming firepower, and that's well on the way to being achieved. But what then? If Gaddafi's forces and the rebels become more evenly matched, perhaps Libya will tear itself apart in a bloody civil war. I don't think that's what anyone would consider a desired end state. According to Lord Stirrup, until recently the Chief of the Defence Staff, when interviewed on Radio 4's Today programme on Thursday, it's quite clear that the political end state is the removal of Gaddafi from power. The trouble is, that's not what the UN resolution authorises, and it's not what our armed forces are specifically working towards. They're working towards establishing a no-fly zone, and apparently doing so successfully. But what happens next? If Gaddafi's forces all give up and defect to the rebels, and the rebels succeed in swiftly replacing Gaddafi with a lovely democratic government, then everyone's happy. But what if they don't? It seems to me that that important question just hasn't been given enough thought. That's a shame, and there's really no excuse. Not only is the principle of having a clearly defined aim written into British defence doctrine, but recent experience should reinforce the importance of that principle. Take, for example, Afghanistan. We sent the troops there in 2001, largely because of a vague feeling that after the 9/11 attacks, it would be a good thing to go and bomb the shit out of a country that had possibly been linked to the attacks. No one really thought about what would happen next, and almost 10 years later, our troops are still there and still getting killed, 362 so far. Gaddafi is clearly a bad guy, and making it harder for him to put down a thoroughly legitimate rebellion is a worthy aim. So on the whole, I do think the current military action in Libya is justified. However, I worry that the long-term aims of the operation have not been properly thought through. I really hope I'm wrong. This has been Adam Jacobs for The Pod Delusion.
The other big event this week was the budget, the set-piece parliamentary event where, whether he actually is or not, the man in the cabinet who looks most like the spoilt public school bastard child of rich parents gets to lick his lips and tell the poor people just how much they're going to be punished for being poor. It's a good job Matt Baker didn't ask him how he sleeps at night, as he'd probably just say he sleeps in his coffin, in the dungeon, in his castle. I don't like George Osborne very much. But anyway, the major theme of the budget was about the Tories' plan to encourage growth in the economy. Perhaps one thing, though, that the politicians have failed to overlook when thinking about growth is that maybe it's not an economic factor or a political factor, but we've simply run out of things that are fairly easy to invent. Tyler Cohen has written a short book called The Great Stagnation on this so-called technological plateau, and John Treadway has been speaking to him to find out more.
Something strange is happening. The most talked about book of 2011 so far is not about teenage vampires. In fact, it's about scientific innovation, economics, and the links between them. The Great Stagnation, how America ate all the low-hanging fruit of modern history, got sick and will eventually feel better, is only available as an ebook. It costs a mere £2.30 on Amazon.co.uk and is just 15,000 words long, half of which appear to be in the title. It's by Tyler Cowen, who's a professor of economics at George Mason University, and is co-author of the popular Marginal Revolution blog. I spoke to him about the book and its success, and then went on to ask what the central arguments mean for the UK and its economic policy.
Well, there's a common sense observation behind the main argument, and that has to do with comparing the change my grandmother saw in her life with the change that I've seen in mine. So she was born in 1905, and from the time she was born to the middle of her life, she moved from a world where most people lived on farms to a world where almost everyone has a car and electricity and a flush toilet. And modern life started in that period. And if you look at those years, rates of economic growth for the typical person were quite high. If we look at my life, I was born in 1962. And other than the internet, the way life looks, what we do, it hasn't really changed that much. And if you go back for the United States in particular, and you look at the numbers, if you look at the rate of income growth for the typical family since 1973, it's gone up only a small amount in this country. It's gone up about 20 to 30%. And that's over a time period of almost 40 years. So in my book, I call this the Great Stagnation. It's that the rate of progress in the United States has slowed down.
What is it about the book that you think's caught the imagination and attracted so much coverage?
Well, I think everyone senses in the economy right now, there's something wrong in a lot of countries. The United States, also the United Kingdom. And everyone has been so focused on the financial crisis, which of course was a terrible event. But the notion that there's something much deeper and more fundamental and underlying behind our problems, I think it's starting to sink in with people. So here's a hypothesis. It's actually what I call a villains-free hypothesis. It doesn't blame it on the left wing. It doesn't blame it on the right wing. It says science is really hard. We shouldn't take progress for granted. And that for a while, our world has been at a technological plateau. That it's hard to make a lot of progress in a lot of areas. Like it's hard today to educate the marginal student, but in, say, 1950 or 1930, the marginal student was someone really smart, really motivated. They just hadn't before had enough money to actually get a good education. So that's another way in which progress has slowed down. The numbers for your country are a little different for ours. Like the U.S., there's been a slowdown in median income growth for the United Kingdom.
Right.
But it comes a bit later, and it's not quite as much of a slowdown. I think in the case of England in particular, what happened is that before the Thatcher years, England itself lagged behind some of the other Western nations. So you had a kind of catch-up period. And in catch-up periods, when you're not on the frontier, you can have higher rates of growth. But I think now England, the UK, Great Britain have more or less caught up. And that you will face this dilemma in an especially stark or binding form. It will be very hard to jumpstart growth in the United Kingdom, the way I see it.
Well, it's interesting because our Chancellor, George Osborne, has talked a lot about the forces of stagnation. It's hinted that by this he means too much union influence, he means that the tax levels, corporation tax levels are too high, and he's talking about creating a similar policy to one pursued by a Thatcherite government, creating local enterprise zones in relation to this forces of stagnation phrase. Are these the kind of things that will address the great stagnation, will address the problems that you're highlighting?
In my view, those policies will create relatively small gains. Arguably, they're a good idea. I wouldn't get into that now. But they're really not going to address the great stagnation, which is rooted very fundamentally in the nature of science, the nature of education. Look at it this way. Education, healthcare, and government are growing sectors in most Western economies. Those are exactly the areas where productivity is hard to augment. Results and value are difficult to measure. Accountability is low. So the more your economy is full of healthcare, education, and government, of course it's going to be harder to grow more quickly. And these very particular policy changes, you know, local councils running the libraries, whatever, again, maybe you like them, maybe you don't, but they really don't come close to addressing the basic problem, which will require new technological breakthroughs.
What about, I mean, and you mentioned there some of the policies on the left-wing politicians are talking about a lot in the UK. Another thing that gets mentioned a lot is income redistribution, the fact that the wealthiest have become more wealthy relative to other sectors of society. And there's a lot of talk about trying to address that. Presumably that's equally not something that's going to address the fundamental issues in question.
That's exactly right. At best, it's a one-time change. But if over time the forces are not operating on your side, the underlying technologies, it's not really going to work.
In the final chapter of the book, Cowan looks at what can be done to address the great stagnation. His focus is on science, scientists, and the wider public attitude to them. He says, "It is a big help if people love science, care deeply about science, and science attracts some of the best minds." Given the importance of these topics to Poddelusion listeners, I asked him if he could expand on them.
Is it possible to tell whether this stagnation in the last, 40-odd years, it's just the nature of science, that sometimes there are plateaus. Innovation's not non-linear. It doesn't grow at a constant rate, and at the moment we're on a plateau. Or is it possible that it's something more fundamental about the point we've reached in scientific progress, that it is just harder now, and it will continue to be harder?
I'm not sure those are fundamentally different explanations. If you look back at the history of economic growth and technology, It's never been linear. It's always come in bursts.
Yep.
There doesn't have to be anything wrong with that. Do I think we're stuck forever? Absolutely not. I think we'll see big breakthroughs in the biosciences. And I think also with the internet, it's just a matter of time. Right now, we're treating the internet as a glorified mail order catalog, which is fine. I love Amazon.com. Over time, we'll organize our entire economy around the internet. There'll be this like hollowing out of visible retail. Cities and suburbs will look very different, but that's still a few decades away. So I think we can already see a lot of positive forces set in motion. It's just that the extreme optimists think those benefits are going to arrive tomorrow. If you look back, say, at the history of electricity, it really takes quite a few decades between when you get an innovation online and often when it transforms everyone's lives and really boosts economic growth. So I'm not really pessimistic. It just takes more time than most people think.
No, I was going to say, I've seen a lot of people saying that you're pessimistic and that you underestimate the potential for growth. Are they just misunderstanding you, or is there something willful in the categorizing it as a pessimistic book?
They're just misunderstanding me. You could say, in a sense, I'm pessimistic relative to someone who denies the problem altogether.
Yeah.
but given that there is a problem, I think actually my prognosis is an optimistic one. We will grow out of it at some point. It's not a political conspiracy. It's not the end of progress. It's not the moral collapse of Western civilization. We just, for several decades, need to live with rates of growth which are less than we're used to expecting.
Near the end of the book, you talk about some measures you think might help, and you talk about raising the social status of scientists. And that's something I think will be particular interest to our listeners. Could you talk us through what kind of measures you're talking about and why you think they're important?
Well, if I think of my own country, the United States, here, the social status of scientists was much higher in the early 1960s than it is today. And this is a striking change in terms of role models or characters on television. I think both the U.S. and the U.K. need to be more like Singapore culturally, more obsessed with engineering and production and science and progress, to have tougher standards. And this is a change that has to come from the bottom up, not from top down. I'm not talking about Obama or Cameron getting on TV and awarding a science prize to someone. That's fine, but it's not going to do the trick.
I know you're a fan of people like Ben Goldacre, who are actively campaigning against people who dress up what they do as science rather than promote science in and of itself. Is that the kind of, they're quite grassroots measures, is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
That's a start. Goldacre is about what I would call respect for the scientific enterprise. He's skeptical of the scientist, because that's what science is. So it's somewhat of a subtle position. I know it's a little hard to put on a billboard, and there's some real work to be done here, but we've seen so many changes in people's attitudes in both of our countries. I don't think it's unrealistic to hope that we can see progress on this issue too.
Staying with the theme of technological stagnation, here's Pete Haig following up on the previous interview and wondering if Moore's Law coming to an end is indeed a sign of this technological stagnation. Personally, I'm looking forward to the point when Godwin's Law stops working, as I want to go back to accusing people of being Nazis, just like my grandparents used to during the war.
I recently read an excerpt from a book, The Physics of the Future, by Professor Michio Kaku. In the excerpt, he talks about how Moore's Law has run its course and discusses the possible consequences of this. Moore's Law is a prediction, some say self-fulfilling prophecy, that transistor density will double every 18 months. Pack more small transistors onto a chip, and you can make faster processors, larger memory chips, and so on. Anyone with an interest in computer hardware has witnessed this phenomenon themselves. The exponential growth in the complexity of our electronic devices has fueled the high-tech economy for decades, allowing ever more functionality, a treadmill of increasingly shiny devices for people to buy, and allowing programmers to get away with less optimization of their code. Kaku points out that this exponential growth is due to hit hard physics-based limits in a decade or so. At a certain point, as the component dives down to the nanometer scale, quantum effects start to dominate, and the component no longer functions predictably. This is going to have some consequences. Moore's law has provided Western economies with an easy source of growth, and as of 2020, or maybe later, it's likely that this source of growth will dry up. Certainly, the computer industry will be able to squeeze some performance gains from parallel processing and code optimization, but these will be patchy improvements compared to the across-the-board boost that Moore's law currently provides. Without constant improvements in the capabilities of devices, people won't feel the need to replace them so often. Adding more processor cores might allow increasingly powerful desktop computers for a while, but that is highly contingent on the software industry supporting the increasing concurrency, which is by no means a given. Furthermore, one of the big areas of expansion now is handheld devices. And once you can't make the transistors any smaller, there's only so many cores you can add before a mobile device becomes a brick or an immersion heater. Without a constant turnover of new devices, the industry is going to be in trouble. Everyone will own a computer as good as the ones currently on sale, and won't buy a new one until theirs breaks. The computer industry will have to slow down. This is a specific instance of the low-hanging fruit problem that Tyler Cowen was talking about. The computer industry is gobbling up the last decade or so of its easy growth. And whilst growth beyond that will certainly be possible, it will be harder simply as a matter of physics. I've read Cowen's essay on the subject recently, and I agree on many points, largely because I'd previously thought of them myself. This is either a massive coincidence, or a lot more people have noticed this kind of technological plateau than I suspected. I do, however, disagree with his myopic insistence on the primacy of markets for measuring all value. Take his remarks about teachers, for instance. He claims they are underperforming because of stagnating test scores despite rising education costs, and the solution is more private schools to let the market decide. Firstly, test scores are constantly being tweaked, so cross-generational comparisons are not that easy. Secondly, it is not the job of teachers to raise kids. The fact that most teachers have both high and low attainment pupils indicate that they are not the variable in that equation. Thirdly, attempts to introduce markets into education have almost universally been a disaster. I'm not sure how Cowen thinks he can raise the social standing of science at the same time as showing such disrespect to teachers. This market fixation reflects on the Moore's law problem as well. Most early solid-state electronics research was government-driven. Once the integrated circuit was well established as the basis for computers, then the market was able to make these small, incremental innovations to push that technology forward, and this process is due to reach its natural conclusion in a decade or so. The market is a decent enough algorithm for optimizing processors, but it's inherently short-sighted and short-termist. When money was being pumped into the new integrated circuits in the 1960s to produce guidance computers for the Apollo spacecraft and the Minuteman II nuclear missile, there was no market incentive involved. In really cutting-edge stuff, there generally isn't, because it takes quite a while for people to figure out how to make a consumer product out of new technology. In light of this observation, I'm very sceptical that Cowen's idea of consumer-driven innovation is going to mitigate the effects of technological stagnation. There is nothing on the horizon that can replace Moore's law as a source of growth in the computer industry. It's reaching a fundamental physical limit. You can't get around that no matter how many incentives you offer. There's also the possibility that other fundamental limits may blunt the effectiveness of Cowen's market-based solutions. A blog published in the Wall Street Journal, brought to my attention by James, highlights the increasing difficulty of scientific discovery. Citing studies, Johan Lehrer shows that the size of teams that produce papers and patents has increased at a rate of around 20% per decade, and that, for some given examples, discoveries are increasingly more difficult to make. This dependence on larger and larger scientific organisations is at odds with the inherently divisive nature of markets. Individual scientists, ruthlessly following their own self-interests, are unlikely to form the kind of coherent group required for serious innovation. Furthermore, if discoveries are more difficult to make, they will take more time. contradicting the quarterly profit focus of modern markets. There is definite evidence from multiple directions of our technological stagnation. However, I don't think we can save from this and continue indefinite growth on a finite planet simply through market incentives. The laws of economics must ultimately be subject to the laws of physics. This is Pete Haig for the Pod Delusion.
Now, it turns out that there's a plan to send a probe to a Martian moon containing microorganisms from Earth. This has kicked off a big ethical debate in the space community about whether this could contaminate Titan, or indeed the Martian surface itself. So if we ever do discover life, we won't know whether it actually came from Earth in the first place when we sent it up there. Personally, I don't see what's wrong with sending life to other planets, especially if that life happens to be James Dellingpole and Melanie Phillips. Here's Kash Farouk, hopefully with more details on how we can actually get them sent up there.
A couple of weeks ago, a story broke that declared that evidence of alien life had been found inside a meteorite. Tracks, impressions and fossilized remains of bacteria had been found that could only be alien. It was impossible for that rock to have been contaminated by Earth bacteria. The news was published in a paper and everything. It was published in the Journal of Cosmology. And the paper was written by a NASA astrobiologist, somebody called Richard Hoover. Amazing news, don't you think? So why didn't the world's astrobiologists jump for joy? Because Hoover has made the same claims before, many times, and the Journal of Cosmology also has form. This website-only journal has, according to P.Z. Myers, been set up by a small group of crank academics obsessed with the idea that life originated in outer space and simply rained down on Earth. This hypothesis is known as panspermia, and some astrobiologists do believe that this is a plausible explanation for how life started on Earth. The hypothesis states that it would be possible for life to be blasted off one planet by some sort of impact, hitch a ride through interplanetary space on a meteorite, and then to land on another planet. Hoover's paper was quickly debunked by many, and NASA distanced themselves from the announcement. The general conclusion was that this was another example of very weak or misinterpreted evidence that isn't doing the panspermia hypothesis any favours. Even so, a major experiment is being planned for later this year to test the claim that microorganisms could indeed survive space travel. The Living Interplanetary Flight Experiment mission, which has the appropriate acronym LIFE, is being developed by the Carl Sagan-founded Planetary Society. The experiment will send selected microorganisms on a 3-year round trip to Mars on the Russian Phobos Grunt spacecraft. The primary mission for this spacecraft is to land on Phobos, one of the moons of Mars, grab a sample and then bring it back to Earth. The LIFE project will simply go along for the ride. And the microorganisms to be sent will be very carefully selected. The astrobiologists really do want to give the experiment the best chance of success. Extremophiles, organisms that can survive in extreme conditions on Earth, will be used. For example, an organism that can cope with radiation will be sent. Another thrives in high temperatures. There is controversy too. There is a protest group. It is called the International Committee Against Mars Sample Return. It has criticized the LIFE project as a violation of the Outer Space Treaty of 1967. Now, even though the Outer Space Treaty sounds like something from Star Wars: The Phantom Menace, it is actually real. And it does have sensible rules, like you aren't allowed to place nuclear weapons in orbit, or on the moon, or on any other celestial body for that matter. Another rule states that you can't land on something, stick a flag in it, and claim it as your own. The key part of the treaty that the protest is based on is that space-travelling nations must avoid contaminating space and celestial bodies. The International Committee Against Mars Sample Return say that the LIFE project should not happen because Phobos could become contaminated by the earthly organisms, or the spacecraft could lose control and crash into Mars, contaminating that instead. It is a risk that scientists think is worth taking. The Journal of Cosmology and Richard Hoover must be very excited. This has been Kash Farouk reporting about aliens and spaceships for the Pod Delusion.
Finally this week, some music! Whilst watching the budget, I sent out a tweet asking if anyone could write a version of Santa Claus is Coming to Town, but about the budget. Thanks to the magic of the internet, would you believe this now actually exists? The lyrics are by James Firth, and the song is performed by William Battle, channeling the Sex Pistols.
1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4!
You better watch out, you might want to try. The budget's out and Osborne's been snide. Georgie Claus is coming to town. He's made a list, it's quite precise. A Tory mix of naughty and nice. Georgie Claus is coming to town. It's swinging cuts are sweeping, but there's icing on the cake. You might want to cry, not when they first ain't come, when you touch it so high. Georgie Claus is coming to town. Here's the gist, he's skating on ice. The headlines tomorrow may well be nice. Georgie Claus is coming to town. The devil's in the detail. So you better watch out, you might wanna cry. You pay your tax, city traders get high. Georgie Claus is coming, Georgie Claus is coming. And his bullshit budget will cost you a crown.
And that's it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen back in full to the Secularist of the Year award ceremony, which features speeches by A.C. Grayling and Sophie Intveld. Also on our website, you can listen back to older episodes, like us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter, and leave us a nice review on iTunes. You can find out how to do all that at poddelusion.co.uk. Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Liz Luckendorf, Adam Jacobs, John Treadway, Pete Haig, Cash Farouk, William Battle, James Firth, and me, James O'Malley. The charity appeals were by Sean Ellis and Martin Norris. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
This is Jesus, and he is down on his luck. In years gone by, people used to look up to him, literally in most cases, as his effigy was usually high on a church wall. But now, not so much. His early work split the critics. Some said he was the son of God, others that he was just another prophet, and yet others that he did none of the things that the other two groups claimed he did. But they all worshipped his father. After a while, the pressure of trying to live up to other people's perceptions of how the son of a wildly successful father should behave started to take its toll. See also Charlie Sheen. But, unlike Mr. Sheen, who isn't the heir to the cleaning fortune I'm told, he vanished from public life. Like Elvis before him, wild conspiracy theories circulated. Some say he died, some that he ascended into heaven, but a growing group of people say that he probably never existed in the first place, and all the stories told of him are a myth, like the lost city of Swindon, stories made up to scare children. But today, here he is, in this Indian restaurant doing close-up magic tricks for the amazement of customers and tips. He used to raise the dead, walk on water and turn water into wine, but now he's asking them to pick a card, turning tricks for patrons who order their food overly loudly and slowly. You feel guilty now, don't you? Or at least you should. We've edited this piece so that you should feel that. Look at him. Look at his sad face. Look at it. You can help. You don't have to send money. Yet, there's plenty of time for that. All you have to do is tick the box that says Christian on your census form on Sunday, and then maybe pop into a church once or twice a year, but make sure it's the right sort, nothing with millimeters. So please, tick a box and say you believe. It's that simple. And you can promote Jesus back to his rightful place as a worshipped deity.